spend. There's no age of innocence. Just make your dollars and cents. Wonder where the time went. Where our lives and where they spend. Can you see it? Can you touch it? Can you tell?
Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints on today's show. In British Columbia, the Comox Valley's 10th annual Coldest Night of the Year fundraiser hopes to collect $225,000.
For those who are less fortunate and marginalized and vulnerable, the need isn't going away for housing affordability or food security or people who are hurting. So we set a huge target for ourselves this year in 2025 to raise $225,000.
Also in BC, an exhibition highlights the work of the Haida master carver Christian White. The exhibition will be on display until 2026.
It's a great feeling to be here in the Villarede Gallery and see all these pieces in the exhibition together. And, you know, it kind of shows the generations and the different decades, really, of my carving career, my art career.
And to the province of Quebec, which is facing one of its worst flu seasons in years, some 4,500 cases were revealed in lab tests last week alone, a peak not seen since the COVID-19 pandemic.
Thousands of people die of the flu every year, and so it is not a trivial illness. It is actually a rather significant one. And so thousands of people dying, many thousands more getting sick, ending up in hospital, that takes up a lot of resources.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello, thanks for being with us again this week. My name is Boris Chassin. I'll be with you for the next half hour. And in the company of our national correspondents, our first stop will be in British Columbia this week, a new exhibition at the Bill Reid Gallery of Northwest Coast Art in Vancouver is celebrating the work of master Haida artist Christian White. The retrospective exhibition entitled Kill Yada Christian White, Master Haida Artist, presents a retrospective of the renowned carver's works, ranging from stone argillite sculptures and silver jewelry to cedar bentwood boxes and ceremonial masks. The unifying theme running through the entire exhibition is one of family and community. It tells the story of Kill Yada Christian White's unwavering commitment to uplifting his family and community through apprenticeships, the revival of cultural, artistic, and cultural practices, and the transformation of his own craft into an artistic community that preserves, shares, and pushes Haida art into the future. Jesse Wensloff of Burnaby, British Columbia, met with the artist.
The retrospective exhibition, Kill Yada Christian White, Master Haida Artist, spans the career of the renowned carver and multidisciplinary artist, ranging from stunningly detailed stone argillite sculptures and silver jewelry to cedar bentwood boxes and ceremonial masks.
It's a great feeling to be here in the Bill Reid Gallery and see all these pieces in the exhibition together. And, you know, it kind of shows the generations and the different decades, really, of my carving career, my art career. And also to kind of educate people that come here to see, I think they could view our community, our Haida community from Haida Gwaii, you know, through a lens here and be able to see, you know, just like our different movements that we've started through the years, you know, the revival of our arts and culture, our ceremonies, our connection with the ancestors. Each one of the parts of the exhibit show that, really, and the value that we place upon our work, you know, that we have created over the years.
The unifying theme running through the entire exhibition is one of family and community, as the exhibit tells the story of Kiliata Christian White's unwavering commitment to uplifting members of his family and community through apprenticeships, the revival and renewal of traditional artistic and cultural practices, and the transformation of his own craft from a commercial endeavor to make ends meet into the center of an artistic community that preserves, shares, and pushes Haida art into the future.
My name is Amelia Ray. I am the assistant curator here at the Billery Gallery and the co-curator of this exhibition. This was really exciting and felt very natural. I grew up really closely with Christian's daughter. She's my best friend. And I grew up as a lead dancer in his dance group and spent a lot of time at his longhouse. So it kind of felt really right that we would put this on for him, and also like a lot of pressure because him and his family have just done so much for our community, so it felt really, it was a lot of pressure to be like, how can we honor him in the magnitude that he deserves. That was so important to us because that's how we know him, and you know, all the collectors and people who know his work know him as an argillite carver and somebody who's selling in galleries, but to Haida Gwaii, he's the person who does so much for our community and for the preservation of our Haida culture. And so it felt really important that we honor that and reflect that in this exhibition, because he's, you know, you think of Christian White and he's so much more than just Christian White. He's his family and his dedication to our people. And he said something at one of his potlatches in 2022 that he's doing this out of the love for his people. And I think that we tried to reflect that the best way that we could.
While Kiliata Christian White has been sharing his culture with the world by creating and selling sculptures and other art since he was a youth, he eventually realized that through his art, he could build and strengthen his community in Haida Gwaii, preserving and revitalizing his people's traditional culture and heritage.
But midway through my career, I realized that we don't have to sell everything. We could keep what we want. We could keep things for our own use and our own culture. And so I found a way to do it. Something that wasn't really even heard of. We were encouraged, back in the day, we were just encouraged to sell everything, to burn everything, to move on. But in a way, it was our culture that kind of saved us and saved my family. You know, we had nothing left. There was no fishing industry left. Logging was just devastating our islands. And so those weren't directions I wanted to go in. And so I was drawn to the arts. And now I encourage visitors to come to our islands. And what I encourage them to do is to take a picture, to go for a walk, to buy a piece of art, to support a living artist. So that's what I do, and I try to educate them.
This community-centric revitalization, helped by Kiliata Christian White's apprentices, has included a resurgence in the creation of one of the Haida's most iconic works.
You know, right now it's raising as many totem poles as we can on Haida Gwaii. There's a revival of that also. In 2017, I carved a totem pole. I had 8 apprentices, 4 female, 4 male. And then we carved a totem pole. It was standing as a tree December 1st or so. And then by June, it was standing as a totem pole. And I believe every one of those students really learned and gained a lot from that experience, as I did. And then I've seen a pole being raised in Haina, which is another ancient village. Another one was down in Kai'au or whatever, down in Windy Bay. So there's a revival of bringing totem poles back out onto the land, into the ancient village sites again. And so, you know, there was a big gap of 125 years of no totem poles being carved, and now it's been revived. And so there could be even a full-time carving in my community where I could have many apprentices, and I don't even have to do it all too. We have other master carvers, journeymen that can carry it about. And so I think we've started that revival, really.
Beyond creating new works and preserving traditional techniques and methods, Kiliata Christian White's teachings build and strengthen community and provide his apprentices with structure, purpose, and sometimes a lifeline.
Like, I've probably kept a few people out of prison. So, or, you know, from going into that line, you know, just getting in trouble. And so I've been able to deter them from that lifestyle. But, you know, of course, it's up to them, too. So it's not a total foolproof, but it gives them an alternative. And, you know, there's some, you know, that have difficulties. You know, they might have a mild disability, or they could have other troubles in their lives. They need alternative type of education. Sometimes the school model is not the only model. You know, sometimes, you know, it's a different, more holistic type of model that they need. And then they can move back, you know, to the school system. Sometimes they got to get that something out of their system. And they got to feel proud about themselves. And, you know, it's worked well for me. And, you know, some of them will move off to other specialties or other activities, other careers. But that's fine. They'll still have those tools, that knowledge behind them, and then that pride in the culture.
Kiliata Christian White's legacy is further cemented by the works of his apprentices, who have taken his traditional teachings and shaped a bold new future for Haida art.
Haida art is going in many directions. We have some artists working in Haida manga. We have artists that are working in filmmaking, graphic design, working in multi-graphic type of materials, you know, children's books, you know, incorporating the Haida language. And you also have a lot of people involved with the textiles. For the most part, I try to focus on the traditional parts first, and then once they're done with me, they could go any direction they want to go. And of course, you know, there's jewelry, there's weaving, you know, so there's many different directions we can go.
Kiliata Christian White, master Haida artist, runs until February 2026 at the Bill Reed Gallery of Northwest Coast Art in Vancouver. I'm Jesse Wensloff.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
We stay in BC, where the Comox Valley is warming up for its 10th annual Coldest Night of the Year fundraiser, with a new record goal of $225,000. This will help support the Comox Valley Transition Society and the Dawn to Dawn Action on Homelessness Society. Over the past 9 years, the Comox Valley community has raised an impressive $1.2 million for both organizations. And Comox is not alone. The Coldest Night of the Year fundraiser is held in over 200 communities across Canada. The event is a walk in the cold through downtown Courtenay to simulate the experience of the community's most vulnerable people for one night. Comox Valley Transition Society Executive Director Heather Ney and Comox Mayor Nicole Minions spoke with Heather Watson in Nanaimo, British Columbia, about the importance of the fundraiser and what it means for the community.
The intention of being a walk on the coldest night of the year, in quotations, is that we experience a little bit about what it's like to be outside in the cold and then only have a small bit of food at the end. So we're trying to mimic the experiences of some of the most vulnerable in our community.
Comox Valley Transition Society and their partner organization Dawn to Dawn are warming up for their 10th annual Coldest Night of the Year fundraiser taking place on February 22nd. Heather Ney, Executive Director of the Transition Society, says the successes of past years have empowered them to reach even higher this year, with a bold fundraising goal of $225,000.
So this is the 10th year of the Comox Valley Coldest Night of the Year. In the previous 9 years, we've raised approximately $1.2 million that have been split between Dawn to Dawn and the Comox Valley Transition Society to support those who are homeless, hungry, or hurting. And I think it's really important to note, with that incredible $1.2 million, how generous and compassionate our community is. And for those who are less fortunate and marginalized and vulnerable, the need isn't going away for housing affordability or food security or people who are hurting. So we set a huge target for ourselves this year in 2025 to raise $225,000.
The Coldest Night of the Year is a North American fundraiser and has over 200 communities participating across Canada this year. Locally, the event is an evening walk around downtown Courtney, putting participants in the shoes of community members experiencing hurt, hunger, and homelessness. The family-friendly event has been a landmark success for the past 9 years in the Comox Valley, as the community turns out to support the two organizations, Nay says.
I think it is a testament to the Comox Valley and their generosity in that we have been in the top 20, I think, in almost every year. And last year, in 2024, we raised $190,000. And out of 180 locations across the country, we were number 10. So our little Comox Valley that could is just an outstanding fundraising machine when it comes to Coldest Night of the Year. And I can say on behalf of both EVTS and Dawn to Dawn that we are so grateful, and that all those dollars raised by our community have made a difference in the lives of people in our community.
Comox Mayor Nicole Minions has taken part every year. She shares how she got involved that first year and why she keeps coming back.
It was about 10 years ago when it was first starting, and the company I worked for at the time was one of the sponsors. So I got involved as kind of our company spokesperson, and I brought out my family because it's a very like family friendly, it's really, really inclusive as far as who can do the walk or who can volunteer there. And once I kind of saw that, I've been participating ever since. But one of the big things was I know the really great local work that the two organizations are doing, Comox Valley Transition Society and Dawn to Dawn. In my 20s, I worked or volunteered at a number of transition houses in Vancouver and then also in Port Alberni. And so just being someone who worked in that environment, I just think it's so important for us to, you know, raise funds for people that may need that house or that shelter and home in those times. So I really, really like the work that the two organizations are doing locally. So it was easy to keep participating.
Minion says that while working in shelters, she saw firsthand the diverse group of people needing access to transitional or supportive housing to get their feet back on the ground.
Any one person could find themselves in that situation, and it's just a really important piece of the puzzle with making sure we find shelter for women, families. I know that there's also men's groups and victim support services that they do, so they really do touch every area of the community. And I love that when we go out and walk here in Comox or Courtney, it's going directly to those local organizations that are really supporting local women, local families. So that's just really, really important to see that that money is kind of staying in the Comox Valley.
Minion says the support of the community is something to be proud of, with hundreds of people in the Comox Valley championing this Coldest Night of the Year walk. She reflects on 2024, when the Comox Valley raised the 10th most funds of all Canadian communities.
It just really showed how many people came together, and it really is individuals. There's lots of businesses. It's something where so many people in the community are really aware of the day of when it's happening, and you can really see it in the amount that gets raised. And I know the goal this year is $225,000. So there are large donations that are being made throughout the community, and I think that's just something we can be really proud of how much we champion it regionally here.
Minion says that once the funds are raised and everyone gathers to walk, the evening is a fun night of community connection, with the walk beginning and ending at the Native Sons Hall and a couple stops for hot chocolate along the way.
All in all, it's a couple of hours, but you go down, you participate, and you just run into a lot of familiar faces and people. The actual night of or evening of the walk is a really fun experience to participate in. Once you've raised the money and everyone's got their toques on, it's a real feeling of community down at the event.
Minion says this community event is a good opportunity for her children to learn values like supporting others.
I've been bringing my boys down again for 10 years, and every single year we go out as a family, and I kind of talk to them a little bit about why we're walking, why we've raised funds, and a little bit kind of in a kid-friendly way, but I try to teach them that it's really important to look in your community and see where we can kind of raise some good karma or raise the spirit of people that might need a hand up. So just trying to teach them that value a little bit. And this event is one really easy and nice way to be able to do that.
Heather Nay says that when it comes to the Coldest Night of the Year,
locals should care, because having a home is paramount in people's mental and physical wellness, and that when people don't have a place to call home or food in their bellies, there are many negative outcomes for that. And that particularly related to women and children, if they don't have a place to restart after fleeing violence, have a reset, a place to call their own and to recover and heal from the violence that may have been inflicted and the children have witnessed. Sometimes those negative things repeat themselves in generations. So it's important that children have every opportunity for well-being and a bright future. And I hope, or I know that raising these kinds of funds and providing affordability and housing is, the benefits are immeasurable.
Nicole Minions encourages anyone in the community to join in the event.
I think I would just encourage anyone who hasn't come out to the coldest night of the year but wants to, just to go check out the website and join a team. You can join Team GoMox, you can join another team, you can volunteer. But for anyone who hasn't participated, it's a really nice day and evening, and I encourage anyone to come out if you haven't been. And those who keep coming out, I say kudos to you for participating. I think we do amazing as a region.
This is Heather Watson.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
And we close our show in the province of Quebec. It is facing one of its worst flu seasons in years. Things are not looking that good across the country either. Quebec's public health authority reported over 4,500 cases in lab tests last week, a level not seen since the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Christopher Labus is a lecturer in McGill's Department of Epidemiology, Biostatistics, and Occupational Health, and an affiliate member of the Department of Global and Public Health. He acknowledges that some of the increase is due to changes in people's habits since COVID-19. However, he still encourages Montrealers and Canadians to get vaccinated, both for their own protection and to reduce the risk of infecting others. Jules Bugiel in Montreal, Quebec.
We're hearing that flu cases are seeing a rapid increase in Canada. Just how bad is it right now?
I mean, this is sort of typical for what we would tend to have. The reason why this flu season looks a little high is because over the past 5 years or so, the typical sort of pattern of the flu was really disrupted by COVID. In 2020, 2021, that was sort of the first year where we had zero flu cases in Canada because everybody was largely at home. People were wearing masks. The public health measures were in place. So the past few years have been a little bit atypical, and the flu seasons were not sort of regular. They were happening a little bit earlier. One year they happened a little bit later. So if you erase all of that, if you look back at what the flu has been like historically, this is not that unusual in the grand scheme of things, but there are a lot of flu cases going on right now, and it's unclear when exactly we're going to reach the peak, but there certainly has been an increase right now, and there are a lot of people getting sick, and that unfortunately puts a lot of strain on the healthcare system.
Okay, that's good to know that it's not completely unheard of, because you hear something like, you know, Canada is seeing more than a 20% increase in 1 week. Quebec is seeing more than 4,000 cases in the past week, which, you know, we haven't seen anything like that in recent years. And I think most people do start to worry, especially, as you said, coupled with the difficulties and the strain that puts on the healthcare system. I'm wondering if you could speak to some of those difficulties, because most people who get the flu, you know, they're just going to want to stay home, take some time off school and work and get over a fever, things like that. But obviously for at-risk groups, things can get a lot more serious, which can demand a lot of time and attention from healthcare professionals. What is that looking like on the ground? What's the situation in the ERs right now?
Yeah, so we tend to sort of trivialize the flu, and we'll say things like, oh, it's just the flu, we'll, you know, you'll get over it. The reality is the flu is pretty dangerous. Thousands of people die of the flu every year, and so it is not a trivial illness. It is actually a rather significant one. And so saying that this is, you know, or if we say that this is going to be a typical flu season when we look back in retrospect, that's still pretty bad. And so thousands of people dying, many thousands more getting sick, ending up in hospital, that takes up a lot of resources. And the healthcare system is not in great shape right now. ERs are overcrowded, wait times are long. So anything that makes the situation worse is just contributing to the burden that we are seeing in the healthcare system. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you're young and healthy, you're going to say, oh, well, I'll survive if I get the flu. This is not a big deal. Yeah, it's right. It's true. You probably will survive. But there's a lot of other people that are going to have it much worse than you. And that contributes to a healthcare system that struggles. And that's bad for all of us because we're all patients and we're all going to get sick at some point. And not doing what we have to do to try to limit the burden on the healthcare system is eventually going to turn around and have an impact on us as well.
In recent years, it's been possible to get double vaxxed, right? A COVID vaccine and a flu vaccine at the same time, you know, through the public system. Financial barriers that existed in the past for getting a flu vaccine were lifted in recent years. But, you know, despite that, are we seeing the same pickup for the flu vaccine? Is it something that people are still getting in large numbers now that maybe they feel like, you know, there's less pressure to get a vaccine for COVID-19. Have those numbers changed at all for the flu as well?
Well, yeah. So we have not been very good at Canada, at uptake for the flu vaccine. And I think part of it is, as you were mentioning, you know, prior to COVID, you had to pay to get the flu vaccine if you weren't part of the high-risk groups. And that created in a lot of people's minds this idea of, oh, the flu vaccine is only for people who are very sick. If you're young and healthy, you're fine. And that's going to take a very, very long time to overcome because those ideas stick with people. And so, you know, if you are young and healthy, are you going to survive even if you don't get vaccinated? Yes, you probably will. But you're going to get more sick. It contributes to the spread of influenza. And we have to start thinking about vaccination in a more global, communal aspect, which is, it's not so much about you as an individual, it's about what happens to the community as a whole. And what we know is that as we increase vaccination rates, the healthcare system and the population does better as a whole, even if the benefit to you as an individual is actually quite small. But that's a very subtle message to wrap our heads around. And it's not always an easy thing to do, especially when the public health messaging isn't clear and concise. And a lot of people, whether it's COVID or influenza or anything else, will sort of say, it's like, oh, well, I'm healthy, so I don't need vaccination right now. And that's going to be the really big public health challenge, the big public health message challenge that we're going to have going forward in the years to come.
Yeah. And just to wrap up, you know, speaking of this year, is it too late to get vaccinated? Is there still going to be much of an impact if we're already seeing this big spike now? Should people who haven't, you know, made the time to get a vaccine yet be trying to book something?
I would, yeah, because there's a lot of flu going around right now. And if you haven't gotten sick, you still would. There's still a lot of influenza. We haven't reached the peak of flu season yet. So it's not as if cases are decreasing. In fact, they're increasing. So yeah, if you haven't gotten vaccinated, I still would. Now, flu cases will eventually start to come down. The flu season will eventually end, but we are not at that point right now. So, you know what? Yeah, because it's free. It's a very simple thing to do. It's not hard to get an appointment to get a flu vaccine. It costs you nothing, and it is actually going to pay dividends down the road, because when we say things like it's just the flu, well, don't forget, again, thousands of people die of the flu every year, and even if that's not necessarily going to be you, it's still going to make you quite sick.
To sign up for a vaccine, Montrealers can head to the Clic Santé website. I'm Jules Bichel with the Local Journalism Initiative.
And And this is how we close our show this week. Thanks to our journalists, Jules Bugiel, Jesse Winsloff, and Heather Watson. Thanks to our national editors, Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
Redemption. You Americans have gotten so cocky. You think hockey's your game now. We didn't even have Cale Makar, but all of a sudden we're going to hear all the excuses when we pound the shit out of you come Thursday because a few of your guys got the sniffles. It ain't going to matter. We got Makar. We got McKinnon. We got McDavid and Crosby in the lineup, and we are going to light you motherfuckers up. We're not the 51st state. Fuck your tariffs and stop complaining about the booze if you want to poke the bear. We're going to W.
Ladies and gentlemen, those were the glorious words of Paul Bissonnette that you just heard. I'm at a loss for words. Every head must bow and every tongue must confess. There is only one Lord of Hockey, and that Lord is Team Canada. Paul Bissonnette's got a point. These cocky American poo-faced ding-a-ling, ding-dong, smelly cats think that they own this country. Yeah, right. Who gives a crap? We just showed them what hockey is, who the owner of hockey is. What a tournament. But yeah, we owe, first of all, let's start by saying this. We owe Jordan Binnington a massive apology. I didn't even do an introduction. Kyle, Sam, and Adam are here. I'm Sam, obviously. Sorry. But let's get back to more important things. We owe Binnington a huge apology. Like, he is the new great one in many respects. I don't know what to say. Like, what is there to say? He just purchased the United States of America, and he made them the fourth territory, not even a province. No chance they're becoming a province before Yukon, Northwest Territories, and Nunavut become a province. So you gotta actually apply for that. They can become a territory first, and he just dominated them. He's the new governor of that territory, lieutenant governor, before His Majesty King Charles III, King of Canada, rightful liege lord.
Well, yeah, I don't really know how to follow that one up, but... I'll add that someone on Wikipedia did actually change the official owner of TD Place in Boston to Jordan Binnington. I thought that was hilarious.
Like, and the new president of Hockey USA is Connor McDavid.
But yeah, you can edit things on Wikipedia like that, right? So someone changed it. I thought that's pretty funny. And if those that don't get the reference, so Jordan Binnington also won a cup there in St. Louis, right? So he's got a bit of a history in the TD Place. Unfortunate for the Americans, I suppose. But yeah, as Sam said, a glorious hockey game. And I mean, a pretty big moment for hockey in general. We were talking earlier that, I mean, I don't think they've published the official estimates for viewership, but one of the most viewed hockey games in history, USA versus Canada. Obviously, some larger things than the game were at play. But, you know, Canada pulled through. definitely I sighed in relief to that one. I didn't want to hear any more noise from down south about any of our prized hockey there. But good thing to silence them. I'm sure the Olympics will be pretty heated too.
Yeah, I think this is a good precursor for the Olympics and even the World Cup of Hockey, because they announced that that's going to be happening in a couple of years. So hopefully we get to see the return of Russia and Czech Republic and then Team Europe and Team North America. I know a lot of people really liked having those teams when they did that tournament back in 2016. I want to talk about the undertones, the political undertones of this tournament, because I really think that it had a tremendous impact on the players and their mentalities going into these games. So one thing that I have never seen in a all-star game before, or even, you know, honestly, in a North American sporting event, I don't think I've ever seen any kind of game that relied on so much political influence to be as competitive. Like, I feel like my expectations were heightened because of the political tensions in North America right now. Mm-hmm. Which I don't think I've ever seen in any other sporting event in North America, like I just said. But do you guys feel the same way, or do you guys think that this is something unique, or is this something that happens in Europe with football all the time, or South America? I don't know. I just, for me, it was very unique.
I mean, I could say I could see it happening for other sports, but the difference I would say is the frequency. This is totally out of the blue. Canada doesn't normally have obviously there's a friendly tension maybe over some games with the U.S. We've had that in other sports too, but I would definitely say in Canada, we don't often play games. People compared this to the Summit Series, and not just because of viewership, because of, mm-hmm. How the political atmosphere felt, right? So that's not really a great thing, but basically this explains to you what was that play other than just the actual game, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll put it this way. I mean, look, this is perhaps too political of a stance for a radio show about sports, but I know, I'm very proud of my country. Canada's the greatest place in the world, and I'll say that loud and proud anywhere. I'll be its greatest critic at home and its most loud and proudest supporter overseas. And I think that's the duty of every Canadian. But there's a lot of national pride on the line. The United States politically is threatening to annex Canada. That's just how it is. Before the game, the press secretary of the White House said they look forward to watching the United States play their soon-to-be 51st state, Canada, and winning. Mm-hmm. And we won. So, yeah, there's a lot on the line. Those guys on that team did not play for any last name. They didn't play for a number. They didn't even play for the logo on the front of their jerseys. They played for the preservation of an idea and an entity that has fulfilled its promise since its existence in 1867. That's what this is. There is a degree of historical significance to that game. This is the same thing that happened in 1812. It was two people who are similar but yet different. And when you attack that difference, emotions get in the way of things. I mean, I'm heated up talking about it right now as I sit down wearing my Canada's Not For Sale hat with my other one that says Fort et Libre in French, which means strong and free. It's just not the same. As much as there can be a proxy war, it's the equivalent to the Summit Series. This was Canada saying, you can't push us around. And they can, and they showed them that. If hockey is to Canada, then Canada is to hockey, and we just own hockey, so clearly we own Canada too. I think that's the moral of the story. And people don't understand that necessarily in the United States, and people may not even understand that they feel that way in Canada, but I promise you that is the source and the root of every single emotion that many proud Canadians feel after we beat the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, while Canada did win this tournament, it does not seem that they've won the tariff battle with the U.S. as Donald Trump announced that tariffs will be going through on Canada and Mexico. Do you guys think we need another a women's hockey tournament to try to get Trump to...
We just did, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Let's get this clear. The women's national team, for the third year in a row, has won the rivalry series against the United States. They won in PEI again for the third year in a row. They only conceded one game in the last 3 years.
Wow.
So, yeah, no, don't worry. The women are taking care of business. We just, I think, talk about them a bit less because, obviously, women's sports still isn't necessarily as mainstream. But, yeah, there is a rivalry, and it's bigger there. Much bigger there, mm-hmm. quite frankly, because they play each other so much more frequently. Mm-hmm. They play each other every year. Every single time there's an international competition, it's a given that Canada and the United States will be in the finals. They're not even allowed to be in the same pools based on double IHF rules now. That's how dominant they are in the sport.
Wow.
But, yeah, that rivalry bleeds thicker than blood.
Was it PWHL players?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, all right.
As far as I know, I think the U.S. has only won one.
They've won one rivalry series since 2005.
Do they have, so they have one gold ever, and Canada has four, right?
Oh, no. Okay, so basically, in double IHF women's hockey, it's kind of 50-50. The Canadian women's team for a long time was pretty dominant, and then the U.S. started winning, and now it kind of goes back and forth. But more recently, Canada's had the upper hand every year. Oh, but yeah. The U.S. has a few gold medals in women's USA hockey.
Oh, really? I thought that. Okay. I mean, yeah, anyways, the head-to-head is, like, quite stark, though. Like, I thought the Canadians have a lot more wins head-to-head.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. And let's be clear, too, for men's hockey, the United States has only beaten Canada four times in its history, five times in its history. Three of those wins came in 1996. One win came in 2010 in the Olympics. That was Sidney Crosby's first ever loss, wearing the Canadian national flag on his chest. And then the second loss that he had, which was the fifth time the United States beat Canada on a best-on-best competition in men's, was this year. And then, of course, after that game, they came back and won. But yeah, Canada men's hockey in the since we've been keeping track is 15-5. Canada's won 15. The United States has won 5 of those games. Yeah. And that series too, I think the United States in 1996 actually ended up winning that competition. And I think that was the Canada Cup, but I can't remember.
They ended up playing the States 3 times.
Yeah, they did in that same year, and they lost all 3 times.
Wow!
But on that, I don't really know what happened that time. But yeah, all 3 of those wins were the same year. So crazy. I guess the point, though, is that things are changing a lot, because let's put this in the greater perspective, the broader view. The U.S. beat Canada 3 times in 1996, and they didn't beat them again until 2010. That was the second last time before Canada played the United States since this Four Nations Cup. Canada won, obviously, the gold medal game in 2010, so they got their revenge. But in the last 4 games these guys have played each other, they're 2-2. They're 50-50 since 2010. Mm-hmm. So what I was saying earlier is just that the gap is dwindling a little bit. But here's my thing, and I'll just say this bluntly. I still think Canada is better than the U.S. for a few reasons, one of which is the United States relies extremely heavily on their NDTP, the National Development Training Program. Team USA could only foster one national team that could have even stood a chance at this Four Nations Cup. And obviously, they're a good team, right? They beat everyone but Finland.
Mm-hmm.
But Canada could have had a team 2, which could have beaten Sweden and Finland. And they could have had a team 3. Which probably would have lost to Sweden and Finland, but would have still had a good chance. If Team USA fielded a second team, they would probably have lost by 7-6 goals every single game they played. Yeah. So let's just be clear on this. Canada still has a lot more depth. I just think at the highest echelon, the best of the best that are Americans, because they access Canadian training, are extremely good as well.
Mm.
And I do think that this tournament's actually going to change the way Hockey Canada does its development. I don't know. I just have a feeling that the OHL, the WHL, and the QMJHL are going to get a little bit restructured, and that they're going to take the best players from across the country and train them by themselves and make them tour around and play all these other O and W and Q teams. That's my guess. There's no actual talks about this. It's just a theory I have. And I don't like doing the American way of things, but if we want to hold our hegemony as the great country when it comes to hockey, then we have to adapt, because clearly the CHL development program is good, but it is perhaps not good enough at bringing the best out of the best.
Yeah. One thing I will say about the Olympics, though, is I have to say, I think what happened to the Team Canada in the Four Nations and the reason why they weren't more dominant is that almost no penalties were called. Mm-hmm. Almost no penalties are called, and there was actually a lot more physicality than I'm sure they intended. Like, they did not expect it to be like a super physical play. Like, you know, all-star games are usually like almost no physicality.
Yeah.
And it's kind of just all skill. And I think that kind of is why the U.S. had a bit better shot against Canada, because they had a bunch of guys that just happened to be really physical players.
Right.
Whereas Canada drafted basically, you know, a team that was missing anyone that was like super physical.
Yeah.
Like they had, Pareko a bit. But
Harley was pretty
yeah, Harley,
physical too. Yeah.
But Harley wasn't in at the start.
No, he wasn't.
He's only 23.
But my point is, in the Olympics, physicality is much less of a factor usually, because they just call things like way quicker.
Yeah.
So I would say Canada's actually stronger going into that, just because I feel like the special teams were so strong for Canada, they literally didn't get to use them.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I also think that I noticed that a lot of these games are very low shooting. Mm-hmm. They didn't take a lot of shots in these games, and the goaltending was quite mid, honestly, throughout. Like, Binnington obviously stood on his head in that last game, but the goaltending wasn't really stellar, other than what I saw from Connor Hellebuck. I thought Hellebuck was quite impressive in the
oh yeah
first 2 games, and then even against Canada he was strong. But Why do you think that was? Why do you think the shot totals were down so low? Do you think that's just more of a...
I think
the better players are being more picky with their shooting, or...
I think, I mean, it goes back to the power play thing a bit. Mm-hmm. Basically no power plays. I mean, if you watch how the U.S. is playing, I'm not going to lie, the first game they played in Canada, like, they went up 2-1, and they just stopped playing the game entirely. Mm. They were dumping from center ice. They were just trying to clog up the neutral zone, and every time they got the puck, they didn't try to make a pass. They just dumped it into the, you know, other... in the Canadian zone.
Yeah.
So, you know, playing that kind of hockey, probably not going to be too many shots. I think the reason why the U.S. won that first game, too, is that, you know, Canada came out hungry. They just didn't realize, like, how serious the U.S. has taken that game. Like, the U.S. came out and said, you know, we're going to play this game like it's like a Stanley Cup final, you know, game seven, where we don't care about scoring at all. We'll literally just, you know, tank the game, ice the puck as every single shift if we have to, just to win by, you know, a single goal and scrape by.
Yeah.
So I think that mindset was a shock mm-hmm. to Canada, too, and the physicality, too. They were, like, you know, that kind of shook them up a bit.
Yeah.
So I think Canada would do better to have, like, maybe one or two physical players they add to their roster, potentially, mm-hmm. in a remaking of the Four Nations. But I don't know about IHF, like, hockey, like, actually... in the Olympics, if they need that, just because I think physicality is less of a factor.
Yeah, I agree with you that physicality is definitely less of a factor. But then with Olympics, one thing that I could definitely see being a red flag is you play more games, right? You mm-hmm. play more group stage games. They might have to play a qualification game if they don't win all their group stage games. And then they've got the quarterfinals, semifinals, and then medal rounds, if they even get there. And with that, I think you're going to need stronger goaltending. And I don't think that Canada has fantastic goaltending right now. And there's honestly not a lot of good young Canadian goaltenders.
Yeah.
A lot of that, I think, has to do with the price and how much it costs to become a goalie now mm-hmm. in Canada, with equipment and then other assorted fees with being goalie, like, you know, like the mental psych, going to see a psychiatrist and stuff because goalies are crazy.
He saw Hellebuck for the Four Nations game. You see him doing his eye exercise thing?
I didn't see that.
That was freaky. He was just standing, you know, looking on the ice, and he was just moving his eyes like to one side, then the other side, just like for 10 minutes.
Really?
Just as fast as he could. Like,
wow.
It was some weird mental exercise. I mean, I don't know what else he does, but yeah, that was kind of interesting. I've never seen that before.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know what Canada's going to do come Olympics with, because they've got a year? Mm. A year to find a solid tandem
Logan
of goaltending?
Logan Thompson's pretty good.
That's who I was thinking. I think Logan Thompson definitely should be on that team. And I liked Binnington. I think he honestly played...
He only played well
in the last game.
He's not a guy that you can pump out a ton of games for. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think you know, you'd bring Binnington maybe in some bigger moments or for certain games.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right. You can't run Binnington for 10 games. I think you get worn out pretty fast.
Yeah, because I think back to 2010, and they had Brodeur, Luongo, and Fleury. Those were their three goalies, and that's solid. And Fleury didn't even touch the ice. Brodeur barely touched the ice. Luongo played the majority of the 2010 Olympics, but they still had Brodeur play two games. And then even in 2014... Carey Price played every game for Canada, which none of these guys are Carey Price. So I don't know. I feel like you're really going to need to have at least a 1-2 punch going into the Olympics.
Yeah, let's not forget, though, that there is so much criticism towards Roberto Luongo, more than there is right now than towards Binnington at that time. When Roberto Luongo got played, people started, like, there was headlines in the news saying Canada is trying to throw the Olympics away.
I remember that, actually.
Like, no, just so people are aware, Roberto Luongo was not prestigious before the Olympics. It is his Olympic performance that made him who he is today. Mm-hmm. His reputation was built upon that victory. Mm-hmm. His performance in the gold and the semis and the quarters. He wasn't like well known. Well, he was well known before that, but he wasn't the guy. Yeah. Brodeur was the guy before that, and Brodeur played bad.
Yeah. Brodeur did play well.
I mean, Devon Levi, I will say, I think he could be good. I don't think he'll be ready for the Olympics, though.
Yeah.
I think he's still developing a bit. I think he could be a really good goalie, though.
Yeah.
I think it just, I don't know if Buffalo is the place to flourish, but
yeah. And there is
a goaltender, probably not.
There is still a wild card goalie, which obviously hasn't been talked about much because he's at an impeding trial right now, but Carter Hart was definitely probably one of the better Canadian goaltenders before his arrest. So if he ends up beating the case, or I don't know, being found innocent or not guilty, and is able to return to the NHL and play, then we might even see him by the time next year, because I think that case is supposed to happen either this month or next month.
Yeah, so, I don't know. Dude,
that'll be interesting to see.
To be honest, though, I think no matter what happens, I just don't know if Hockey Canada would accept it.
Like, even if he's found not guilty?
I don't know. Let's remember, Drew Doughty went to court for rape, and he just played in this game.
Yeah, so I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did, 2008.
Oh, wow.
I mean, yeah. I mean, and you know why Logan Thompson didn't play on the Four Nations team? Apparently, I thought it was because they didn't know about him really that well, but apparently the assistant coach, I can't remember his name, on the Team Canada has a history with him and doesn't like him.
Oh.
So politics often play.
I thought it was like a Vegas coach.
No, the rumor is that the assistant coach didn't like him that much.
And who was the assistant coach? I feel like it was it all head coaches? The coaching staff?
I think so. It was something tied to Vegas or something. I don't know. I think they didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was preferential treatment there, and they decided not to pick him up. So
okay. Interesting.
So anyways,
he's got the best stats in out of all the Canadian goaltenders. Yeah. He's 5 losses and 27 wins.
No, he's really good. I mean, you could say Washington's super good right now too, but
they weren't even supposed to be good. The Washington
he's playing good. He's definitely aiding to them.
100%. 100%.
You know who else is doing well? Chikrin.
Chikrin is doing well.
Oh, man.
I'm actually surprised he wasn't included, but I thought that defensemen didn't play that bad for Canada. I was happy with their performance.
Honestly,
I actually thought all the players played good. Just the fourth line on Canada was shaky.
Yeah. Mm. I wasn't too impressed with Doughty. I didn't think Doughty looked great in the two games.
I think you're right. I think he had some moments where he looked pretty weak.
Mm-hmm.
A couple times, though, he had some pretty good moments. He had a good breakout or passes, McDavid's first goal against the States in that first game. That was Doughty passing up to him, a stretch pass. It was a nice pass. So Doughty had his moments. I think I was pretty happy with him. I'd honestly be more worried about that as the States. You had a couple guys in the States that were just total liabilities. Jack Hughes was not good.
He's a no-show.
But he was slipping and sliding everywhere. This guy couldn't stand on his 2 feet.
You got to tell me how Brock Nelson makes the final.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Makes the final game, but Kyle Connor doesn't. Kyle Connor, does he not lead the league in out of American
goals? Yeah, I guess.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
And I honestly, funnily enough, I would have said the Americans' weak side was their offense, not their defense. Their defense was very strong. I mean,
Jacob Slavin just played one of the best three-game stretches I've ever seen.
He saved that team. It would have been much different without him.
Yeah, and do you see the praise he's gotten from some of the best stars? Saying he's one of the best defensive defensemen in the NHL. I knew about Jacob Slavin. I never really counted him up there with the best defensive defensemen, but I was impressed.
I think, I'm not going to lie, I think Canada should have had Chris Tanev there.
Chris Tanev, okay. Why Chris Tanev?
Did you see him in the series between Dallas and Oilers last year?
I can't remember it off the top of my head.
Unbelievable. He leads the league in blocks almost every year.
Okay.
He is an absolute rock of a defensive defenseman. He's a Jacob, Slavin type. He's really locked down. In the playoffs, I couldn't believe it. I didn't know about him at all.
Yeah.
Was he the one that
played on the Leafs?
He's playing the Leafs right now.
Okay, all right.
But I was watching him against Dallas, and I couldn't believe how good this guy was. He was literally the difference between the Oilers smoking the Stars, and then, the Stars almost winning, the series there, right? So, he's an underrated player for sure.
Was Bouchard on Team Canada?
No.
No? Was that, surprising or no?
No, not at all. His defensive play is horrible. Yeah. I think he would have lost the Four Nations for Canada.
No,
I'm serious. I like Bouchard. I like him as a player.
Yeah.
But man, his defense is weak sometimes. But the role he'd be filling is Makar's, and Makar is no doubt better than him. So he's not really useful because he plays on what? He wouldn't play on PP1.
No.
So what do you even use him for, right? So
yeah, that's a good point.
I think that one made sense to me. Yeah. But if I were to restructure it, I probably would try to have a tiny bit more of a defensive core. You know what I mean?
So who would you remove? Because I feel like Parayko and Harley were the two that were on the edge.
Harley are solid.
But they're defensive defensemen. So
I
want to take Morrissey off? I liked Morrissey. I thought Morrissey played well.
I think Doughty would age out for the next Four Nations.
I agree with that. Yeah.
So I'd either. Probably stick someone that was a bit more solid in there. Yeah. And yeah, maybe, and then maybe also the seventh guy would be another, you know, solid defenseman.
Yeah.
But I think that's down the line. So
yeah. And I think by the next time that the Four Nations are happening, I think Darnell Nurse will probably be a top one defenseman in the NHL.
Oh God.
So
days, man. He's earning every penny.
On a more serious note, though, Brant Clark could fully be there. Clark could be there.
He could develop.
He's developing well. He's at a good pace right now.
Let's just think about how nasty this next Team Canada team could be. McDavid, MacKinnon, Reinhart will probably still be there, is my guess.
Yeah.
Mark Stone's probably gone. Crosby's probably gone.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. Highly replaceable with Celebrini and Bedard. And Fantilli.
And Nick Suzuki.
Probably not, but I don't know.
But I have to say, I don't know how I feel about Stone. Mark Stone was kind of slowish. He's just always...
He's a slow skater, though. That's his thing. He's a
really,
slow guy. He's really smart.
Yeah. No, but he's... yeah, I mean, he gets injured really easily. I don't know. I thought he was solid, but I think we could have benefited from some speed.
Shifley.
For some more speed, just, you know, I think, especially when you're playing with, like, I think the thing the coach realized really fast, like, quickly, is that you need speed if you're playing, like, a line with McDavid. That's what you want. You want two other guys that are really fast, because you got two players with him that are barely keeping up. It just kind of makes every play, like, break down, because it's just McDavid by himself. I mean,
yeah,
he can handle himself, but better to have someone skating up with him. But, yeah, Mark Stone was pretty solid. I think next time around, he's probably gone.
I don't even know if he has like two more years left in the NHL. Like, I think he'll be gone.
Jeez, he's banged up for sure.
Do you think the States would have won if both Kachucks were healthy?
You know, I actually think they would have lost by more. I'm sorry. Like, Brady Kachuk is a grinder, and he somehow, like, the puck hits him and it goes in the net sometimes. But those guys are complete penalty taking liabilities.
Yeah, but they didn't really take too many penalties in the tournament. Like,
yeah, you know, they took like the only penalties the U.S. got, though.
That's
true. I mean,
they're also just low IQ people. they suffer from critical deficiencies in cognitive function.
Well, this comes from
that's a serious problem.
I have to say, I mean, a lot of people really praise Brady Kachuk, and I get it. He's a great player, but man, like, after watching enough hockey from the guy, like, he's just not. He can be disciplined, but, you know, it seems to be the only thing that can motivate him is, you know, our Orange Peach down south calling him up in the morning seems to get him pretty motivated. But, you know, playing for the Senators, I'm not really sure. But, he's just not necessarily consistent with his efforts, I'd have to say. But on Team USA, you look pretty motivated there. So I guess he can be a top player in the NHL. He just chooses not to be. But
yeah,
I'd say Matthew Tkachuk is better on that front. Like, he seems to show, like, more consistent discipline.
Yeah.
But no, I think you're right. I think they might have been in better standing with the two of them.
Yeah. And I mean, you also got to consider Charlie McAvoy was out too.
Yeah.
And he's a solid defenseman. Like, that is
but it's part of the game. It shows you just how hard they had to play to beat Canada the last game.
Yeah. No, that's, like, a good point.
This is not, they didn't get injured by fluke. Like, that's how hard they were playing just to keep it 2-1.
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
And it injured like half their roster. So it tells you, you know, man, they were sacrificing everything to just dump the puck and hold it at 2-1, right? So
I want to go back to Brady Kachuk for a moment, because Juraj Slavkovsky actually just came out saying that if you want to be successful in the NHL, you have to play like Brady Kachuk. And then in Montreal's game against Ottawa, Slavkovsky got blown up by Ridly Greig, and Slavkovsky didn't even waste a minute, got up and started pummeling Greig, and then they dropped the mitts, and everyone was praising Slavkovsky for that kind of play, and he actually had a really good game against the Sens. He had a goal and a fight. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know. If Slavkovsky wants to keep on playing like Brady Kachuk, and that's what I see from him every night, I'm not really complaining too much. That was controlled. That was reactionary aggressiveness. Like, he took a hit, didn't lay down and cry about it like a certain Timmy S on the Sens. But he got up and fought and stood up. And, like, sure, Grieg's a smaller guy, but, I mean, it didn't really matter. If he got blown up, he's going to beat the crap out of him. So, I mean, I kind of like that.
I agree with the sentiment of, like, I think play like how you envision Tkachuk thinking he plays sometimes. But Tkachuk's a huge guy. I think people forget that. He's a really big player. Like, there's a reason why he can hit people and injure them. Like, he's big. So, you know, that he's definitely got that factor in him. I agree, though. Like, no, Tkachuk plays great hockey, and he's able to just disrupt games by just making big hits, getting in people's heads by just playing hard-fought hockey instead of playing, like, skilled hockey. Like, he's a skilled player, but rarely do you see him, like, stick-handling much. He just kind of rams through people and shoves the puck in the net. Both,
even like, his goal.
His goal wasn't really him doing anything fancy. He just pushed through a bunch of guys, and the puck hit his stick and went in.
Yeah.
So that's kind of usually how he operates.
But on that note, unfortunately, that's kind of all the time we have for today. But thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another episode of Plugged in My Ears.
With the colder months coming up, we're all using more natural